You are listening to the Punk News Podcast. This is features editor John Gentile. I am here with co-senior editor and more and more. What's happening?
Hey, excited for the podcast today.
Well, indeed, because we've got a very special guest, an icon of punk rock from the 70s to now. We're here with Bobby Steele. Bobby Steele, thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, man. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Bobby's got a really, really cool record coming out. It's Act Your Rage, and you might say, hey, didn't that come out in like 1989? It did, but there's a new version of Act Your Rage coming out. It's a new version of the record with some really cool guest stars. It's got Greg Hetz of the Circle Jerks, Alex Story of the Doyle Band, and Cancer Slug, Des Cadena, and Tim Capello, the saxophone-playing vampire from Lost Boys, and a whole bunch of other guests as well. We're going to kick it off with a song, the new version of Evening of Desire, and we will be... Oh, and I should say, the new record comes out the 36th anniversary of the original version. That's May 8th via Bobby's own Postmortem Records, and we're going to play a track from that album right now, Evening of Desire.
You give me love, you give me everything you can. You give me love, you make me feel like I'm a man. All my kisses set me on fire. You're guaranteed to bring anything of desire.
So, Bobby, I think I'm going to jump back in time, and then we're going to work our way to the present, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
You've been involved in punk rock since pretty much the earliest days. Were you involved in music before punk rock, or did you kind of jump into music at the burgeoning punk scene?
Oh, no, I've been involved in music since I was probably about, like, 15 or 16 was when I started, like playing, like, in bands.
So I mean, did you grow up on like Nuggets type rock or like Rolling Stones or Beatlemania? Like what was your like earliest fuel, I guess?
My earliest stuff was like, because I was born in 1956. So, like, you know, I was hearing like all like the early like rock and roll and doo-wop stuff all the time. And my parents were like really into like, you know, all that kind of music. And then, of course, when the Beatles came out, you know, that was a big, you know, that was a big push right there. That's really what like got me to say, you know, like, hey, this is what I want to be doing. Also, you know, then you know, when I was about 7, my best friend's father got a job as the tour bus driver for the Dave Clark Five.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so like the Dave Clark Five would stay at the house down the street, and we'd play stickball on the street with a couple of those guys. And so, you know, I really just got surrounded, you know, by like all the right people. You know, my hometown, New Milford, had, you know, quite a few bands at that point already that were kind of like doing semi well. There was actually one of the bands was called Omnibus, which actually some of their style like influenced like some of the early stuff that Glenn Danzig did. I actually mentioned them to him once, and he said that he used to see them play at a bar across the highway from his house. And they actually did a lot, like a lot of touring, like opening for like Vanilla Fudge, Led Zeppelin, The Doors, you know, like a lot of big acts. So they had an album. They had one album out on United Artists Records, and you can actually find some of their stuff on YouTube today also. They were like very like they were like all these like 15, 16-year-old kids who all they did was work on their own songs. They couldn't play anything else, but they just worked out all these like intricate arrangements to their own stuff and got like discovered and signed very quickly.
So what was the first, I guess, what would you consider the first real band that you were in? Maybe the first band that played a gig or the first band that, you know, had a real practice. What was the first real band that you were in?
That was a band like we called Burlap Candle. That was when I was like I guess about 16. I started it. This kid had just like moved into town, and he'd come I think from New York City, and he played guitar, and he started showing me a few things on the guitar. And we just decided one day to get together at his house and like work on some like Creedence Clearwater songs and things like that. And his sister came in, and she knew a drummer. And so we got in touch with him, and he started playing with us, and we started like doing like really, really lousy cover versions of songs. And we started like, you know, since we couldn't really do good cover work, we started writing our own songs, and we kind of got a reputation as being, you know, a bit notorious in town. We were kind of like the low life bad kids. You know, all the other musicians were into like, you know, jazz and blues and, you know, progressive and stuff like that. So we were like those like dirty rock and roll guys.
You know, one of the, and we're gonna get to punk in a second, but one of the interesting things about punk is often seen as a reaction, I guess, to album-oriented rock, you know. But you're talking about the Dave Clark Five and Omnibus, who was kind of a psych band. Did you ever feel that conflict that punk has a reaction to something, or maybe punk was just an evolution for you or a de-evolution for you?
I think it was a bit of a reaction because at that point, things had gotten to the point where like progressive rock was like the big thing. If you really wanted to have a band, you had to like have like a Moog synthesizer, which in today's dollars would cost you about $15,000. You had to have a Mellotron, which in today's dollars is probably about $50,000. So it was getting where like only like the kids with the money could really like form a band. And so like, you know, punk rock came out, and all of a sudden it was like right back down to just playing guitar.
Now, you talked about how you grew up in Milford, New Jersey, and I believe you moved to Manhattan in the late 70s, correct? So how did you get involved in punk rock? Was that New Jersey and Manhattan? How did that happen?
It started in New Jersey. You know, we I had some friends, and we were just like starting to, you know, I mean, we were into like collecting, you know, unique records, and you know, there was all that like bad publicity about the Sex Pistols, so we had to like check into that. And I just happened to go into a local record store, and they had a copy of Anarchy in the UK. So I bought that and took it home, and the moment I put it on, I was just like, this is just like so intense. I mean, it was like nothing, you know, I'd ever heard before. So it just like really hooked me, and that progressed us to like Patti Smith and the Ramones, and we just like really started like digging around for like, you know, more, you know, and more of like the obscure punk rock stuff. And You know, I mean, I remember going into the store and picking up Damn, Damn, Damned and flipping the jacket over and looking at it and going, that doesn't look like them, and putting the record back, back on the rack and finding out, like, later that, it was a misprint and they had put Eddie and the Hot Rods picture on the
Right,
back.
right.
I could have had that one in my hand, So, it was just like that kind of a thing. We would just see always searching for something, like it was going to fit into like that niche.
I don't mean to go off on too many tangents, but you bring up an interesting thing. Bobby's referencing the very first press of the first Damned record, which has Eddie and the Hot Rods in the back, which is now a very valuable and hard to find record. Bobby, do you collect records, or maybe, a lot of musicians don't collect records because they're in the midst of it, and some do collect it. Are you a record collector or not really?
Not anymore. I was. I let go of my collection like about like 12 years ago. It just gets out of hand. I just like now I don't really have much time to like really like do anything like that to, keep track of that kind of stuff. But originally, I had like all like the original like television 45s, all that kind of stuff. And at one point I just like I unloaded it all.
Apropos of nothing, sadly, David Johansen just passed away. Bobby, did
No.
you ever see the New
And
York
Brian
Dolls
James.
and Brian James? So, did you ever see New York Dolls in the early days, or Damned in the early days? Any memorable shows or interactions?
I saw the New York Dolls. They actually played a local bar on my birthday when I was like, I think it was 19. And it was 2 nights, 2 shows each night. So I went for like all 4 shows, and it was probably like 20 people there. And that was when they were doing the red patent leather thing, and Malcolm McLaren was there. And I just saw this guy who just like, to me, he just like looked like this like goofy Harpo Marx type guy. And I was like, who's that guy? And somebody said, oh, that's their manager. That was great. To be able to see those guys like live, in a small place was really, that was a great experience for me. And then I saw the last like, I think one or two shows that the Ramones did at CBGB's. I saw the B-52's debut show at CBGB's, opening for the Cramps. I got to see like a lot of really, really, interesting, exciting shows. Like back then, CBGB's was like such a different place than what it became like, in the 90s. I remember going it there like, a fun thing was to go on Monday nights because it was like audition night. And so you never knew what you were going to see. And this one night, the Dead Boys do a reunion show.
Oh, where? Oh, that famous reunion show at TBGB's. That's cool.
It was always, great surprises. And the bands only did like a 20-minute set. So, the first show would be like, I think at like 7:30, 8 o'clock. And then they would empty the place out, and there'd be like another show at like 11 o'clock midnight. And it was
What?
always packed.
Well, that's real cool. Getting back to like Iggy Pop. If you say Iggy Pop, what does punk mean to you? And Iggy Pop is like, I don't worry about the concept of punk. I'm Iggy Pop. I'm paraphrasing. But if you ask somebody like Jello Biafra, the concept of punk is very important to him. How important is the concept of punk to you? Is that something you don't really worry about, or is that something that you see as a set of values or artistic expression?
I mean, I never really thought about it, so I'd have to think about that a bit. But to me, punk was just like really just bringing back the purity of rock and roll. It had nothing to do with anything political. It had nothing to do with, any like social movement or anything like that. To me, it was just like really bringing back like that like late 50s, early 60s, leather jacket, back in the streets, rock and roll, thing. Getting, you're writing your own music. You're not. You're basically like saying, "F you" to the industries, and just trying to do things your own way.
Well said. I believe the way you joined the Misfits is someone showed you like the Cool Cough single, and you sort of didn't dig it, but you went to check them out, and they were like different than the single. Is that how you joined the Misfits?
Kinda, yeah. We were doing a gig, and we were actually playing. It was a boys' club in Lodi, and this kid came up to us like between sets, and was like talking to me, and he told me he had some friends who had a band. It was called the Misfits, which was ironic at that time because the band that I had at that time, I would want to call the Misfits, but the other guys in the band thought it was a stupid name. And that kid was Steve Zing.
Oh,
Yeah. Okay.
that's funny. That's funny. That's funny.
Yeah. And then a while later, I was like, I think I was at Eddie's Lounge, and they had the Misfits Cough Cool 45 on the jukebox. And that's when I saw the sleeve, and I kind of like looked at it, and I was like, this doesn't look like anything I'd be into. But then I had a falling out with my band, and so I was looking for another band. I put an ad in the local music paper, and I came home one night, and there was a note there that Glenn Danzig had called up and wanted me to like come and do an audition. So I went, I did the, I was still kind of like, well, I wasn't interested at that point because all I'd heard was Cough Cool. And to me, that just like, it wasn't like my idea of rock and roll. But I just, at that point, I figured the best thing to do is like practice auditioning, so you get comfortable going in and not being nervous and fumbling. So I was going and auditioning for bands just to practice auditioning. And I went to audition for the Misfits. And they showed me a few songs, and it was different than Cough Cool. And then after like we played for a while, they brought me back inside Jerry's house, and they put on the Bullet 45. And as soon as I heard like Attitude, I was just like, this is what I'm looking for. This is the sound that I've always looked for in a band, just like raw energy, speed, and aggression, but with a melody.
This is a little bit before your time in the band, but did you ever have any interaction with kind of the forgotten Misfit member, Diane DePazza, who I believe was the very first bass player of the band, if I have that right?
In the early days, she was coming to shows and taking pictures. So that was, and at that time, I didn't know that she had ever like been in the band at any point. But I think you can even like find some pictures of us at Max's, and you can see her like on the side, like taking pictures.
And I believe the first 7-inch you were on was Night of the Living Dead, correct?
No, the first one was Horror Business.
Horror. Okay. Horror Business is one of the most iconic singles of all time. Horror Business, Teenagers from Mars, Children in Heat. You were playing guitar on it. Some of the most legendary guitar playing ever. Did you feel like you were putting down something special at that time, or was it just another day in the recording studio?
No, actually, no, that's the funny thing, because after I did the audition and I came back to like New Milford, and I ran into some of my friends, and I said to them, I just got into this band called the Misfits. And I said to them, I said, these guys are going to be like as big as Kiss. I knew it. And like when I would say things like that to Glenn and Jerry, they would look at me like I had three heads. Like that could never happen. And I would say, we could be playing the Garden. And they would like kind of like look at me sideways, like you're out of your mind. And like, what are they doing now? They're playing the Garden, places like that. So I was right.
You were right. It must feel good to know that you are a major contributor to literally some of the greatest and most iconic punk rock of all time. How does that feel to know that you are like, on the Mount Rushmore of punk rock? You know what I mean?
It's kind of like, you got to pinch me sometimes because, looking at that and like seeing like, what it's become, it's just like, it's kind of like what I kind of would cockily say was gonna happen, but to actually see that it actually happened is like a totally different thing for me. So yeah, it's just like, I'm pretty amazed that like it all really happened, because it was almost about to die. And really, thanks to Metallica, that kind of like put things back in the spotlight and just made it all take off again.
And we're going to get to the Undead in a second. I just got a couple of last Misfits questions for you. You're on what I might say is the greatest Misfits album of all time, but it's never been released, 12 Hits from Hell. And the listeners probably know it's a somewhat controversial and it's almost a Frankenstein album in that it's got Bobby and Doyle playing guitar on it, of course, and they were never in the studio at the same time, of course. Do you have feel? I know you re-recorded that album in like 2021 or something, like your own version. Do you have feelings towards that version? Should it come out? Do you feel it's kind of a Frankenstein and the original one with you should come out? What do you feel about that album?
I think it should come out just as it is right now. I mean, because me and Doyle, our sounds and our techniques are so like different, but they come together so well. You know, he's got this very aggressive, I don't know how to describe it, but his sound is much more harsh than mine, where I kind of have a bit more of a bluesy, Johnny Ramone-ish, you know, Johnny Thunders type flair. So the two sounds, you know, are distinct. It's like the difference between John Lennon and George Harrison. You know, you don't want to have two guitar players doing exactly the same thing. So like, to me, like 12 Hits was like really a great blend of the two of us.
And actually, you bring up a very interesting point. You mentioned George Harrison and John Lennon, I think. I guess this, how influenced were you by, you sort of talked about this a little bit, but how important is, I guess, the idea of melody and songwriting in punk rock? Because a lot of bands would argue that melody and even songwriting isn't that important, and energy and aggression is what's important, or energy and feelings. But I'm going to put words in your mouth, and you can respond to it. I feel as though you would say songwriting and melody and I guess maybe perhaps traditional songwriting skills are very important.
Yeah, they definitely are. You know, I mean, because you can take any good song and turn it into a punk song. You know, I mean, you know, you can take something from like the 20s, and if it's got the right kind of a melody and you've got the right mindset, you can turn it into a punk song, because it's still, you know, and especially I point to the 20s, because back then, like, there was a lot of tongue in cheek. It was kind of like, it was almost like that same like punk rock attitude, where like people didn't take life seriously, and so like a lot of the songs were like pretty crazy.
Do you ever talk to the other Misfits anymore, or not really?
I talk to Doyle every once in a while. I've talked to Googie. The last time I talked to Googie was probably about 10 years ago or so. Sometimes I'll see Mike Graves, because he actually I live like about four blocks away from like where he grew up. So, you know, I run to him every now and then. Supposed to be going over to the Misfits headquarters to meet up with like Robo and a few of the other guys at some point. So that could turn out interesting, because one of the things that happened recently was we got a 4-year-old granddaughter, and my wife decided to like get her some pets, and she couldn't just get her any pets. She got her too many horses, and things got to the point where we couldn't afford to keep them like at the place where we were renting space for them anymore. So she was looking around, and somebody mentioned that there's a guy that has like a horse rescue that we had met like years earlier. He knew who we were, and he said that we could like keep our horses at his place for free for a while. So we called the guy up, and it turned out he had bought Jerry and Doyle's father's old farm. So it was like literally around the corner from like the Misfits factory. And
Okay, wow.
because me and Diana have been like close friends with Kenny for years, she just mentioned to Kenny that we were like keeping our horses at his father's farm. And he says, "Well, you guys need to stop by." He's like, "Robo's always here, so and so's always here." And Diana was like, "Well, you know, you think Jerry would be happy if Bobby showed up?" And he was like, "Well, you know, people got to grow up." So who knows what, you know, what become of things. I mean, I've heard rumors, you know, and so you never know what could happen. You know, I'm open.
You bring up a real good point. Is in the interwebs, in more than punk, but hardcore, you know, NYHC hardcore, there's two or three sets of guys that are in the news again because they're beefing again, and they've been beefing for like 30 years,
I
40
know.
years. It's like, you know what? Does that matter anymore? You guys made rad records.
Yeah.
Just enjoy the rad records together. You know what I mean? So I hope that goes well,
Yeah.
Bobby.
Yeah, I'm
And
friends with like a lot of those guys, and like, you know, it does bother me to like, see that they just can't seem to like drop it and like, you know, get over it and, you know, move on with their lives. You know, it's like you say, you know, like some of these disputes are going back like 30 years, 40 years. It's like, you know, all it's doing is eating them up.
Not to psychoanalyze it, but I think of them, everyone is probably has two or three beefs in their brain, and they're probably thinking the same two or three beefs that I'm thinking of. And I think those guys enjoy beefing more than they like being friends. Like, I think they enjoy the beef because it makes their life exciting, or it gives them some sense of, I don't know, competition or something. I think they like beef. Like, if you're beefing after 35 years, you must like beefing. Otherwise, you would settle it and forget it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, in the early days, you know, the things between me and the Misfits, really, you know, in my mind, it was just like a publicity stunt. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, you know, it was like kind of like, okay, this, you know, if we can have like a little bit of a dispute and have fun with it, people will talk about it and they'll talk about us. But, you know, I don't know exactly. I mean, I have a good idea where like that went sour, because up to that last moment, the Undead were on Plan 9 Records. Glenn Danzig was like going like around the cemeteries with me, taking pictures to use for like the record cover, you know? And then all of a sudden, things just flipped, you know? And all of a sudden, there's like friendly taunting. Somebody put a wedge in it, and it just like kind of like blew up.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes people, you know, sometimes fun play fighting becomes real or whatever. Real.
Yeah.
But however, after you left the Misfits, you started the Undead, and of course, I guess the first proper Undead album is Act Your Rage. Did you consider that the first proper album as opposed to an EP?
Yeah.
So Act Your Rage is a great record. It's an iconic record. How do you feel about Act Your Rage? Because you just re-recorded it. So do you feel as though Act Your Rage was imperfect, or do you feel that it was perfect, so you recorded a new version to celebrate the original? So what's your opinion of the original Act Your Rage?
There was a couple of songs, because I was running out of money as I was making it. So there's a couple of songs that I was never really fully happy with the final mixes on it. And, you know, I would like listen to it, and I would, you know, some of the stuff I would think, you know, I wish I had sung that, you know, that one better. You know, it literally, like, for a couple of years after that record first came out, if I like listened to certain songs, my throat would hurt, because I could hear myself singing off pitch a little bit, and I would start feeling this tension in my throat. So, you know, I got over that, but, you know, there was some things that I just wish I could have had more time working on. So, you know, now having a home studio with a lot better technology than those studios had back in those days, it was just the right time to like say, okay, now I can do it the right way. And then Joe and Diana were the ones that kind of like, you know, threw in the idea, well, why don't we try to get some other people in here? And, you know, Diana started, you know, every time she saw somebody that was, you know, in another band that was, a known band, she was always the one that would like go over and say, hey, you know, Bobby's doing this record, and, you know, and just drew all these people in. I mean, we got guys from Guns N' Roses, Megadeth, you know, I mean, you know, we almost had CJ Ramone, and we lost his phone number twice. Yeah, you know, I mean, how messed up can you get, you know?
Actually, I want to talk about that guest in a second, but before we talk about that, the record has a cover of Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction, but actually he didn't actually write it. P.F. Sloan wrote it. But yeah. I know you guys cover Eve of Destruction. I guess just coincidentally, Handsome Dick Manitoba of the Dictators also covered that. I'm just curious. Handsome Dick Manitoba of the Dictators?
Yeah, really. I didn't know that. I knew the Dickies did it.
Oh, and the Dickies did it too.
Yeah.
So why are so many punk bands, I guess, interested in Eve of Destruction, which at the time was kind of considered the hippie national anthem? You know what I mean?
I don't know. In my case, it was just something a friend of mine just like suggested it to me. So, you know, I kind of, you know, he was kind of like thinking, you know, like, take it, do it faster. And I thought, you know what? I want to kind of like try to keep it like at the same speed as the original and just give it like a more aggressive edge and just make it like my own. And then I kind of stuck that like those different chord changes in the middle for the solo, because I wanted to create like this impression of like a war, you know, so there's like sirens and there's bombs and things like that, you know, so I kind of like want to kind of throw like a bit of a Jimi Hendrix like influence like lead in there.
The new record is out May. The new record, which is the new version of Act Your Rage, is out May 8th via Bobby's Postmortem, which is the 36th anniversary of the record. The record's got, like I said before, it's got Greg Hadson on it, Alex Story, Dez, Tim Capello. I'm just going to ask you about some of these guys. Dez, even though people think of him as a California guy, he's actually a New Jersey guy. Did you know him from his New Jersey days or his California days? And also, Dez was a misfit as well, actually, now that I think about it. So how did you link up with Dez, and why did you choose for Dez to be on the record?
I think that was Diana's doing also. I think somehow she's always like on Facebook, so she's always connecting with people. And Dez, like, you know, didn't live far from here. He lived in Newark. And that's where, you know, that's where he found that he grew up. I'd never known that. You know, I always knew him as, you know, a West Coast guy. So I was kind of like surprised. But he was just like, yeah, you know, let's do something here, you know. And like, you know, he was close by. So we were able to just like pick him up and bring him like right here into the studio and have him do his stuff direct, where like some of the guys, like I would just send him like a stereo rough mix. They would throw their stuff down on separate tracks and send it back over to me, and I'd like sync it up and like put it in there.
And then you also have Greg Hetz and the Circle Jerks on it. Yeah. Do you know the Circle Jerks from back in the day, or is that like a more recent?
I knew the Circle Jerks. I knew them the first time they came to New York. I just been walking up Second Avenue, and these guys came walking up to me like, "Hey, are you Bobby Steele?" And I was like, "Yeah." They go, "We're the Circle Jerks," and so like, they took me out for dinner. They took me to a movie. We hung out the whole day. They were like really, really nice guys. We did, you know, we did like one show opening for them like back then. And then I connected to them again when I was living in Los Angeles. And I started doing sound for a couple of bands out there. And I wound up like doing sound for them there. I actually did sound for them in New York City twice. So, you know, we kind of like had a thing. So, you know, when we were being managed for a very short time, and our manager knew Greg. So he put me in touch with Greg, and Greg was like right there to do it. You know, so he threw down for I Don't Want to Go. The hardest part was trying to figure out like what song, what person was going to be on in some of these, you know, some of these cases.
Well, in addition to Hetson and Dez, and also the Hetson and Dez, of course, M, were in Red Cross together briefly, so there's that connection.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
So there you go. But there's also, I guess, what I would call some spicy guests in here, you know, people that I might not expect that are pretty interesting. Like, you've got Alex Story of Cancer Slug, who also sings with Doyle's band. What was the – and actually, he sings a lot on the record. What was the idea of bringing Alex in for the recording?
Well, we love Alex. You know, ran into him a few times. I don't really remember like when we first like met him, you know, but I think it might have been like at a Doyle gig. And then the Undead did a show with Doyle in 2018, I think it was. And Alex came up and sang When the Evening Comes with us. And so we kept in touch with him, and we just decided like, you know, let's get him in on a couple of these things. So, you know, he joined us on Hollywood Boulevard. He did I Don't Want to Go. I can't. And I'm trying to think what else he did. He did, I think, three songs with us on the album.
I would say perhaps one of my favorite contributions, in addition to the legends, is you've – and actually, this guy is a legend. You've got Tim Capello, the sax player from Lost Boys. And also, like, I didn't even know this. He like, did sax for Tina Turner or something like that.
Tina Turner and Ringo Starr.
And Ringo. And I love Ringo. Yeah. What was the reason for bringing him in? Just for fun? Just to be surprising? Or you felt that he has something that no one else has that would make it interesting on the record?
All of the above. He's like, he would always like be like, we would do like these like horror cons, and he would sometimes like be like in the same, like in the same room as us. And so we got to know him, and we were always like, just like so entertained, like watching him, like, you know, get up on stage and play sax with the different, you know, guest bands and stuff. And at one point it was like, at the Chiller Con, which is like the local like horror convention, there's the house band was the Dead Elvi, and they were always the ones that would like back up like Keith Emerson, Mickey Dolenz, like all these big names. And this one year they were going to have Tim Capello come up and be their guest, and they didn't have a place to practice, so they asked if they could practice in our basement. So they're practicing, and in comes Tim. So, of course, we hit it off with Tim, and he's going, wild on the sax here. And so Diana just said to me, "Hey, we're doing this record. Would you be into doing it?" And Tim was like, "Yeah." So we got him, on, I think, three tracks on here, I think it is. Yeah, three tracks on this thing. Plus, he just on the side, he added sax to, I don't know if you heard our song, Her Song. It was
Sure.
also the Undead Summer. Okay. He came in and he threw down a sax solo on that that's going to be like on the next LP.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's just like the most talented and humble guy. I mean, he's just like, is so easy to work with.
Well, that's very cool. I guess wrapping up the interview, do you see the new version of Accurate Age? Do you see it as the album you intended it to be? Do you see it as a companion to the original version? What do you see the new version of Accurate Age as?
Kind of like a bit of both, I mean, it's kind of like a tribute to the original, because the original album just like had such an impact and just really like pissed off like so many record company people who said it would never take off, and then like watched it take off better than like a lot of their own releases did. It was the thumb in the eye to the record industry. I got blacklisted because I was li literally told by like the head of like a pretty well-known independent label that discovered and like launched the career of like one of the biggest bands of all time, and they said to me, like they were at this like industry convention, and my name came up, and they said, "We all have agreed that like you're a phenomenon. Nobody's ever been able to do what you've done, and we've all agreed that none of us will ever touch you."
Do you think you're going to have any live gigs for this coming up, or is this kind of a studio thing?
No, we're planning on, we're already starting to like line up some live gigs. We've got like three shows. Well, we got two shows confirmed in Canada, in Toronto and Hamilton, and we've got one pending in Montreal, and we're talking to a few other people. It's just like, because of the way our situation is right now, we can only do like, we're promoter would like have to fly us out, rent a back line, put us up for the night, and then fly us back home. So there's costed logistics that are involved. We've done it a couple of times. We 2 years ago we did down in Austin, Texas, where we just like caught a flight at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, arrived in Austin at 6, played, and then caught like the very first flight the next morning back home.
So, are you in the East Coast now, or are you still out in California? Where are you at these days?
I'm on the East Coast.
Okay, cool,
Yeah,
cool.
I'm just outside New York.
Well, very cool. Well, listen, people, listeners, I shouldn't say people, listen, listeners. Accurage, again, the new album by The Undead, which is a recut of their 1989 classic. It's got Bobby on it, it's got Hetson, it's got Alex Story, it's got Des Cadena. And actually, I'm just going to read a couple of other cool guests here. Tim Capello, like I mentioned, and it also has, let's see here, a bunch of other cool people.
You got
And,
Bumblefoot? You got
oh,
Bumblefoot?
that's right, Bumblefoot. You've got Bryce Bernias.
Yeah.
You've got Matt Witt. A lot of really cool people.
Steve
Oh,
Garvey.
I
Steve
got
Garvey Buzzcocks.
that. I got to ask you one more thing, and then I
Yeah.
will let you go. And this
Okay.
is not related to anything, but you did a guitar solo for Sloppy Seconds. Are you pals with those guys, or is that just like a one-off thing? What's your connection to Sloppy Seconds? Another great band.
Oh, that's a great story. We had booked like a Midwest tour back in, what was that, like 92, I think it was. And Steven and Sloppy Seconds were going to be opening for us for a couple of the shows. And so I was like back and forth with Steve on the phone a lot. And it was the Monday before the tour was going to begin. And I'm talking to Steve, and this is just like the greatest story, because he says to me, "Bobby," he goes, "I know I'm going to sound like an asshole, but like I had this dream that like something happened and you suddenly like needed a drummer, and I got to play drums for the Undead. And I hung up and called him back like 2 hours later. I was like, "Steve, you're not going to believe what just happened." He's like, "What?" I said, "My drummer quit. My bass player quit because the drummer quit. So I need a drummer and a bass player." And so, like, that Friday, I was on stage in Louisville, Kentucky, with Steve Sloppy on drums and one of his friends on bass. And we did, like, I think it was five or six dates on that. And it was a great tour. It was like so much fun. Like, Sloppy Seconds guys are like just so much fun to work with.
Well, that's cool, and that is trippy. Bobby, it's been real great talking to you. Everyone, check out the new record out May 8th. Act Your Rage Again on Postmortem Records at the 36th anniversary. And we're going to close this on out with another track from that album, I Don't Want to Go. Bobby, thanks again for coming on the show. Very much appreciate it.
Really appreciate it here too, man. Thanks a lot.
What am I doing here? I don't know. Where are they taking me? I don't want to go. They got a chain around my neck, a dagger in my back, down a long, long corridor.
Misfit, one of the most famous misfits. There are a lot of misfits, some more famous
There
than others, some more deserving of kudos than others, but Bobby certainly deserving of kudos. And what did you think of the fact that Bobby said, "Well, I don't," and I'm paraphrasing here, "I don't really talk to most of the misfits too much, maybe Doyle, but I'm going to Misfits headquarters kind of soon, and who knows what's going to happen? What's going to happen, Em? What is going to happen?"
Some form of reunion, I
Hey, you know
think. Some burying of the hatchet.
I actually kind of wish I asked him about it. He talked about how he's cool with Doyle, and Doyle is the guy that replaced him in the Misfits. You think he'd be least cool with Doyle, but I guess Doyle isn't the guy that's, well, that's interesting, isn't it? Well, there's always next time, man. There's always next time. So yeah, Bobby Steele,
Oh,
legendary, great guitar player, and I'm excited for the new record that's coming on out, the new old record, the new, I will say, and I should have said this during the thing is, and usually, you know that usually re-recorded albums are just terrible. You know, like the Dead Boys re-recorded album is terrible. The Fear re-recorded
yeah.
album, you know, it's unnecessary. But the new Undead record, because it's packed with guest stars, I mean, it is a recut of the old record, but it really almost feels more like a live set with like friends. You know what I mean? And so it's cool. You should at least definitely, I mean, in this age where music is essentially free, you should at least check it out. It's cool. So, Em, let's hit a little bit of news. There's some cool news and some not some cool news. Here's some cool news, I think. Raymond Pettibon has donated his entire I don't know if it's his entire, but it's probably close to his entire personal archives to the Getty Museum. Of course, Raymond Pettibon is the artist of Black Flag, but he's also, and also Sonic Youth, but he's also one of the most famous artists of all time. When I was about 14 or 15, I was probably 16 or 17. I had just gotten into Black Flag, although my grandmother was an artist. So, and I, at the time I was reading a lot of comics, because I don't really read a whole lot of comic books anymore. But so she took me, my grandmother was an artist. So she took me to this massive Raymond Pettibon exhibit in Philadelphia. And she didn't even know that I knew who Raymond Pettibon was. And it was like thousands of his works. And it was interesting about seeing Raymond Pettibon's work all together is he repeats a lot of themes, which is interesting, and also his style progresses, which is interesting. But what's also funny is for a period, he was doing a lot of dicks and a lot of images of intense gay sex. And afterwards, my grandmother was like, oh, well, I'm not saying you should do that subject matter. I'm talking about like the art itself. So my grandmother took me to like this art exhibit with like all these wangs all over, which was hilarious. But it was a cool exhibit. What I thought was interesting about this, this came from a press release, and the press release wasn't Raymond Pettibon donates his archives to Getty Museum. It was Getty Museum acquires Raymond Pettibon archives. And then I had to read like almost all the way down. It said that he donated it. I'm like, well, that's kind of a dick move. Like, you didn't buy it. You didn't like search it out from some, you know, collector in Japan. He gave you all his stuff. Like, you would think they'd be like, wow, thanks, Raymond. This is like real cool. But I guess our people are like too cool for that. Like, maybe our people, maybe that's like embarrassing, you know, to do it that way. I don't know.
Just an ego thing, I think. I think that's it. Just like, we know this artist.
Yeah.
They've acquired this artist.
But it'd be one, if they bought it, then I say, okay, they bought it. So they acquired it. But he gave it to them. you know what I mean? Like, I thought that was kind of weird. Anyways, I hope this makes a lot of I hope they make exhibits out of this. It'd be real cool. Em, are you a Pettibon fan?
I haven't seen like all of his stuff, but the stuff I've seen I've really liked. So I definitely want to like check out more. And I think this is really cool. It's really nice when, you know, people in the punk sphere have their stuff like either, you know, donated or whatever, where it's gonna live forever. Like the physical versions of it, because again, there's so much stuff where it's like, oh my god, that thing was so cool, and it's like it's gone now, it doesn't exist. Pictures.
And actually, you know, it is pretty cool. I mean, Pettibon is like super rich, and he should be. But like one of his drawings will go for like $10,000 to $100,000, and he draws them in like an hour or two. You know what I mean? And holy. Keith Morse has stayed like if you go to a studio. Like it's just littered with his work, like on the floor. He just like throws it all like anywhere. You know what I mean? So it is cool that he's making it available to the public as opposed to some rich guy in Russia or something like that. You know what I mean? That's pretty cool. So that's rad. Everyone should go check that out. It's totally cool. I was going to say something else, but Em, do you know who?
Yes.
Is one of the first people outside of the punk world to bring Pettibon's works to, I guess, what we would call the art elite or the hip art people.
The first person. So is this someone who is like in the arts, or is this someone who's like a rich someone person?
In the music scene, then.
Someone in the music scene, but not in the punk scene.
Yes.
Were they ever in the punk scene?
No, but slightly yes, but I think no, because the way yes is like really, I'll explain that later on too.
Okay.
So I'll say no, although technically, the answer is no, but very slightly technically yes.
Madonna?
No, good guess though. I'll give you one more guess. Okay.
Yes. Let's see.
Let me give you a hint.
Yeah. I'm trying to think.
let me think of a good hint here. The hint is... Bippity-bippity-bop!
Stevie Wonder?
Stevie Wonder. David Lee Roth, Em. David Lee Roth. David Lee Roth had a gallery, and he was one of the first guys to really showcase Pettibon's work outside of the punk scene.
Oh, that's cool.
And that was during Black Flag.
That's really cool. What's his kind of punk connection?
So in the very, very beginning days of Van Halen, they actually used to play with punk bands or punkish. They used to play with a band called The Dogs, who were from Detroit that moved to L.A., who were considered one of the very first punk bands. They have a song called Slash Your Face. And actually, one of the punk news shows had The Dogs headlining. And they played with a couple other very early punk bands as well. And there's some weird, not weird isn't the right word, there's an understated Henry Rollins, David Lee Roth connection. And then I think Rollins might be friends with David Lee Roth, but he doesn't talk about it or something. And there's rumors that he helped out or even co-wrote David Lee Roth's autobiography. So who knows?
Interesting.
So that's that story. So that's very cool. Let's see what else here. Em, is there anything specific? I got a couple of other ones, but is there anything you specifically want to talk about? Let's talk about Social Distortion.
Let's see what's on.
Social Distortion have canceled their European tour. It's kind of a weird thing. They originally said, due to unforeseen production delays with our forthcoming album that they've been working on for how many years now?
Like 20.
Like literally like 20. Like, oh.
A lot.
Yeah. So due to unforeseen circumstances, we have to cancel our European tour. We sincerely apologize to our fans and appreciate your patience as we focus on finishing the record. Ticket holders, blah, blah, blah. Now, a band of Social Distortion size, which is a very big band, I mean, they're not like you too big, but they're big, you know, canceling a European tour has wide-ranging consequences. So it was kind of weird. Then, because people kind of like were like, what the hell is that about? They said, just wanted to follow up on our April European tour cancellation. I apologize to all who have disappointed and been inconvenienced by this. I feel it needs a contextual explanation. Due to the health issue, which began on April 23, this put everything to a complete halt for an entire year. We were halfway done with record. In 24, we had to reschedule two huge American tours, which had to be postponed until I had a clean bill of health, if I had a clean bill of health. Throughout this week, we've had to get back in the studio and finish the album, working on producer and engineer schedules. Everyone is playing catch up. I can't tell you how hard I'm working on all fronts to bring you this long-awaited album. Please bear with us. We will be in Europe next year with Dynamite Tour. So excited to share with you all. P.S. Tickets will be refunded, I assure you. So it still seems weird, Em. Still seems weird.
Something's off. Yeah. Something's very off. Like... It really makes me wonder why at the beginning it's, unforeseen production delays. They could have just left it at that. Like, why is there a follow-up statement? You know, like...
Well, I think because it got so much blowback, frankly. But Em, do you really think it is an album thing or do you think it's something else? I actually think it might be an album thing, but I just think it's terrible planning, frankly.
I think it's more the health issue. That's how I'd read it. Is like maybe at the beginning with the first thing they're trying to blame it on the album, and then the second one's like, oh well, there's a health issue. Doesn't say that he has a clean bill of health, right?
But what does that mean? Is that health, wink wink, or is that actual health? You know what I mean?
I would assume actual health. Just because like he had the battle with cancer and all that.
Oh, he did. Oh, now I feel like a total dick. I feel bad. All right. Well, listen. then I feel like a total asshole now.
No.
I take everything I said back. I wish him the best. Em, do you think you're gonna play punk rock bowling?
Yes, I think they're gonna play punk rock bowling because it's in the U.S. and this was in Europe. So I think it's because they're close-ish.
I was hoping I get an Iggy Pop switch in and out. You know what I mean? But listen, I'm glad he's doing better health wise. Although I'm glad he's doing better health wise. But after the whole Dixon thing, where they kind of like didn't care, that was lame, man. That was lame. You know,
it was really weird. Because like that was the other thing I thought of. Like reading this was like, oh, I know this tour didn't have any Dixon affiliation, but it was like, did that affect the ticket sales for this tour? But
I honestly, not. I don't think people give a shit, especially with Social Distortion. One of these bands that like they're punk, but not like if you go to the show, you're not gonna see. I mean, they're not really. They're a band. They're a medium sized band. You know what I mean? A medium sized bigger band. So let me think of a band that is just like a band that doesn't really have like politics as part of them. Like if you were like Blues Traveler and you were like, I love Trump, I'm Blues Traveler. Like no one would care. The fans wouldn't give a shit. They wouldn't even know. You know what I mean? Like, whereas if like Crass were like, or like Steve Vignor was like, I love Trump, which he does not. But if he said that, that would super negatively affect his ticket sales. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So whatever, man. So anyways, I mean, I wish him all the best, but I wish him, well, I wish him all the best. I wish him all the best. I wish he did some things differently. I'm not a huge fan of the band, but listen, I feel like an asshole now. I forgot that he had actual health issues. I'm a dick, M. I'm a dick. And Brian James died. That kind of sucks. Fine.
It does suck.
Of course, the Damned reunited as the original Damned, which I thought would never happen, like 3 years ago or so. And they played maybe they played England too. I think they played Australia and England, or maybe just England. It was Dave Vanian, Captain Sensible, Rat Skybase, and Brian James. And they actually put out like live CDs of every show of the original reunion, and you can order as a box set for like $40. And honestly, it's the same show every time. But it's awesome. Like, it whips. It's freaking awesome. And they were talking about how like they were going to keep doing it, and now they can't, obviously, which is a shame. But listen, man, R.I.P. Brian James, man. I think Captain Sensible put it perfectly. He called him the Riff Master, which I think is true. I think that's accurate.
I would agree. Yeah. He was only 70. I thought he was older.
Yeah. Well,
for some reason.
That is not old. That's a bummer, man. I wonder how shocked the rest of the band was. Like I wonder, was the did he have health issues and that's why they did the reunion? Or did Captain Sensible just get like a text one day, like 4 a.m. and it's like Brian James is dead? It's like, holy shit, you know? And how close friends do you think the Damned are? I think they're not close at all. Like, I think I don't think they hate each other. I just think they really are work associates. You know what I mean? And I kind of think they've always been work associates.
I think I think they're friendly. Like, I don't think they're spending every minute of every day together. But I think, like, if they're in the same city and they're not on tour, they're going to hang out, or they're going to, like, grab food or something and just kind of catch up for, you know, an hour or whatever.
See, I think, and this is basic speculation, what should we do on this show? I think maybe there were some hard feelings, like maybe in the 80s or 90s. And I think now they're just past that, and they realize the way we're going to make the most money is the Damned. We don't hate each other. We're not the best of friends, but, you know, we can work together. We can write together. Although, of course, a couple of the Damned albums are actually Captain Sensible solo records, which is kind of weird. I think was No More Heroes, or what was that album? Not No More Heroes. It had the silver cover. Let's see here. So Who's Paranoid? That record is actually a Captain Sensible solo album recorded by the Damned, which is kind of odd. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And now let's see. Evil Spirits is that Evil Spirits is an album, by all the members. Yep. And Darkadelic, the last one, is that's actually an album as well, actually. Although Dave Vanian wrote some songs, Captain Sensible wrote some songs, but there are no Dave Vanian Captain Sensible co-written tracks, interestingly.
Oh, okay.
But that might just be how they like that might be like that. So that kind of suggests that they're like, what I was going to say is, you said if they're in the same city, they'll get together. I think not. I think they can work together, but I think they are strictly working associates, what are you going to do? Although on the other hand,
fair enough.
I might take that back, because on the other hand, I've seen Captain Sensible and Dave Vanian joking around with each other. Whereas other bands, everyone knows exactly what I'm talking about, they don't joke around at all. Like, they don't even interact on stage. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm, and you know who I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is my square. This is yours.
Yeah. So maybe I interviewed them both a few times, twice, I think. I've interviewed them separately twice. And I've asked them the same question. And they're always like, we're very different people. I think they even say they don't hang out, but you know, English people like English people, even if they hate someone, they'll be like, oh, he's a bloody good chap, even if they hate him, you know what I mean? So I don't know, man. I don't know why I care so much whether the Damned are best friends or not. I care, Em. I care.
We should find a way to ask them somehow. Next time you interview them, just be like, yo.
I gotta say, friends? I like them both. Like, they're both real cool interviews, and if anyone gets a chance to interview them, you should. They're cool guys, they're nice guys. Overall, well, they're cool, nice guys. Maybe their live manager isn't so cool, but the band is cool. So here's the thing that's really not cool, man. The lead singer of Zulu has been accused of abuse. And you can read the whole statement at punknews.org or on anywhere. I guess it was his girlfriend, Simpson. Is that's his girlfriend, right?
Well, like, there's the thing of they were romantic partners, but they weren't romantic partners, and the statements kind of differ. It's hard to tell what their like relationship was. I believe they were romantic partners for a time.
Is one of the two saying they were just friends and that's it?
He's saying they were not romantically involved.
Ever.
I don't believe so. Let me just.
But didn't she like live with him or something?
Yeah, so I do think they were romantically linked at one point.
So anyways, she says that he assaulted her and then used his mosque or people from his mosque to kind of like cover it up or kind of bully her. He says, I didn't do any of that. And as a person and as a Muslim, my faith and moral values guide my actions every day. Islam teaches respect, integrity, and accountability. And I strive to uphold these principles in my life, blah, 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 blah. And he goes on. So you can read the whole statements at Punk News. I'll say, and I think I believe her. And here's why I believe her.
First of all, I believe her too.
The default, there's a phrase, believe women, which I mostly agree with. You know what I mean? Like, I believe, and actually, I must have this conversation. It's good I'm having it with you because I know you have very strong feelings on this. The phrase, right, believe women, does that mean, I'm not arguing, I'm genuinely asking. No. Does that mean believe women every single time, all the time? Or does that mean the systems and processes and culture in reporting sexual and physical abuse have been pillared against women for years? So when a woman says something, she's most likely telling the truth, and we have to account that the system has been negatively pushed against women in that regards for decades.
The second one.
Okay, then I agree 100% with that phrase then. Yep. So I agree with that 100%. So anyway, the point being is I believe her here for two reasons. Well, three reasons. Mm-hmm. A, she gives specifics, although she's vague in some portions, and I never understand why they're vague in some portions. Just say
because,
you know,
it's hard to recount something like that. Like when you're talking about it, you're reliving it.
I guess.
It can be very traumatic.
But sadly, at this point in time, you know you're going to get blowback. So you got to, sadly, perhaps, you have to treat it like a court case and be very specific. You know what I mean? That being said, I believe her. Second, I believe her is because anytime someone's like, I'm a moral person, you should listen to me. These people are bad and I'm a moral person. That person is always suspect, always. And in punk rock, that is abused. And actually in other genres, too. In the hippie movement, certainly, in the reggae. Whenever someone says, I'm moral, I'm a perfect person, I'm a great person, and all these people are bad, that person is suspect. And time and time and time again, we've seen punk rocks and other people that have been, look at Anti-Flag. I'm Mr. Moral, and he's a total creep. You know what I mean? So that's always suspect. Third, anytime someone says, I'm religious, therefore I am good, in any religion, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, whatever religion you want, anytime like, I'm religious, therefore I'm good, that's also suspect. Because frankly, that's irrelevant. And B, you certainly can be religious and do bad things. You know what I mean?
My God. Yeah.
So anytime someone uses that as one of their main line of defense, it says to me, I don't actually have a real defense, so I'm bringing in this irrelevant thing to try to make a defense. So I believe her. I think anytime anyone in the punk scene, I mean, of course, I'm all for preaching values and preaching is the wrong word, asserting values and you know, saying this is right and that's wrong and stating your beliefs. But when someone puts themselves up on a pillar and says, I'm a Dalai Lama, I'm a Jesus, I'm a whoever, that's suspect. You know what I mean? And that's what this guy did. And a lot of other people in punk did as well, including the Anti-Flag guy, just insane. So I think this is going to keep happening. But also, one other last thing, and then I'll throw it to you. In the punk scene, it does seem to me that a lot of people are bully bushwhacked or what, like the wool is pulling over their, like people in the punk rock scene. When someone gets up on a soapbox and says, "I'm moral, I'm good, do what I say," you know, people seem to fall for that time and time and time again, instead of saying, oh, this person's human or that person's human. I would argue that if you take a musician that presents himself as a human versus a musician that presents himself as some moral righteous force, the musician that represents himself as human is on average less likely to be sketchy than the person that presents himself as a perfect moral compass.
I would agree with that. Yeah. Like nobody is a perfect moral
Yeah.
compass,
So, I
and
mean,
I'll, yeah.
I mean, I know a number of musicians in the punk scene where people think you're kind of sleazy or dirty or sexist or whatever, and they're really not, and they're actually like genuinely good people and nice people. I mean, maybe they've got a bit of a persona on stage, but that's not really them.
Right.
And they're cool. And I know a lot, and not a lot, but I know a handful of musicians that people are like, so and so is so righteous and perfect, and they're total scumbags, total scumbags. And that annoys me, Em. So anyway, Em, do you have a take on the situation or what?
Well, yeah, like
Is
what
it the end of
happened?
Zulu? It's got to be the end of Zulu, I think, right?
I think it has to be. Well, they played their show in Brazil without him. They had, I believe, their guitarist step up. They played that show the same day that the allegations dropped, and he released his statement the same day the allegations dropped. They also had their other two upcoming shows canceled. Now, that's something where I wasn't able to find if they canceled it or if, like, who
I
canceled
believe
the
they can
shows.
I believe they
Okay.
canceled it.
Yeah. So, again, like, it just sucks that we see this, like, so much, I was on Instagram and I was like flipping through like stories and whatever, and somebody who I follow like shared this with like the caption, just kind of like, I can't believe, that this would happen, like this really really sucks basically. So I looked into it and I'm like, holy shit, because if you read Simpson's statement, like it gets very, very detailed. Like there's a just so much, like physical abuse, mental abuse, sexual abuse, like everything basically. And like there's stalking and like various types of harassment. So it's never, never a good thing. And again, like she doesn't have anything to gain, from making this up. Like this is 100, this to me, I believe this is something that definitely happened. Also her saying the there's a lot of other people who have been affected, and the this is the persona that this person puts on, but that's not the truth. That's really pretty telling. And also the former drummer, Don Brown, this was in a story post, but Don shared Simpson's statement and just said, "For everyone asked me if I still play in Zulu, this is why I don't." And again, like that's pretty telling too, when you have somebody, a member of the band, who probably like saw this or was like made aware of it in some way, and was kind of like, okay, I'm done. And also, again, just to go back and back up your point, the people who are always there, the people who use faith as a cover are never innocent. Like they're always, it's just like, what can I use that people will feel like bad attacking, right? It's like using a like a human shield kind of vibe. So yeah, this sucks, and it sucks that it's not surprising in one way, like how many more times is this gonna happen? Like who can you trust, who are like decent people out there and everything. So yeah.
Well, there you have it. M, let's wrap it on up. The new Nice album. Are you excited?
I am excited about the new Nice album. I think it's going to be good. I like the singles that they've been releasing so far. What about you?
Yeah, I saw them at Punk Rock Bowling. They were actually really cool.
Oh
And actually, I saw
yeah.
them open for NBC. I think, was that Nice?
I think so.
It was cool. So yeah, man, I'm excited. And actually, I kind of forgot to say,
They have good
you just
energy.
reach us at podcast@punknews.org. We actually got a nice I got a nice Instagram message because I forgot I don't ever say the the thing anymore. This is from Paul. Hey, really enjoyed the Jeffrey Lewis interview. All I heard before was the Crass Songs thing a while back. Really well done. Great interview. Thank you, Paul, for reaching out. You can always use that podcast at punknews.org. Em, anything else you want to mention or cover before we wrap this bad boy on up?
Do I have time for small, shameless self-promotion?
Yeah, of course.
Good. yeah, so...
What if I was like, no, Em? What if I was like, no, no time. No time on this limitless podcast. No time on the show where we've got like 700 episodes. Absolutely not, Em. We gotta shut it down now.
Then I go on a really long spiel about Emerson, Lake, and Palmer's Tarkus.
Oh, I like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Are you an Emerson, Lake, and Palmer fan now? I like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
All I've listened to is Tarkus.
You were talking about Tarkus like last week. Like,
I was.
Why are you so obsessed with like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer for some reason? And
I watched a TV show.
Why were we talking about that? I mentioned the band, but I think you thought the other band was Emerson, Lake, and Palmer or something. Like, was I talking about like Roxy Music or something?
No, I know who Roxy Music is. I think we're talking about psych stuff. Like, just
Yeah.
That, and it just came up because I watched a show, and they talked about like the concept behind the Tarkus album, and I'm like, holy shit, I have to listen to this. So then I listened to it, and I'm like, wow, I need to listen to that again because I missed so much of it.
Em, you should get the record, because if you open up the record, it talks about the birth and death of Tarkus.
Oh, hell yeah. I want the lore.
It's like a dollar, Em. You can get it for like a dollar or three at the record store. Also, I recommend, of course, Brain Salad Surgery, their iconic fourth record. And, of course, Em, who did the cover of Brain Salad Surgery?
I don't know.
I'll give you a hint. He also did the cover of a Celtic Frost album and a Danzig album cover.
Geiger.
Yes, indeed. Actually, yeah, not Geiger, Yeager.
Oh,
I remember when I was in. I mean, he's Swiss, but when I was in Netherlands, I said, "Oh, I went to the Van Gogh Museum," and this woman looked at me like, "What?" I'm like, "The Van Gogh Museum, you know, Van Gogh," and they're like, "Who?" And this was like Van Gogh, and I was like, "Oh." Anyway, Em,
him.
What's your shameless self promotion, Em?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. We ran out of time talking about Emerson.
Yeah, that ate up all the time. yeah. So I'm trying to remember the last thing, but I have a new interview that's up on the site right now. And depending when this will run, there might be two. So that's also exciting.
Em's got a new version of Em tells you what to listen to that'll be up in like a hot minute, like a minute, like tonight. So.
Thank you.
So who's your interviews with Em?
Yeah. So I have up right now, Shiv and the Carvers. I talked to Shiv and Nicole, who are the lead singer and lead guitarist, respectively. They are a skate punk band out of Toronto. I played their most recent song last week on the podcast, and they're really, really, really great. They're ready to release their sophomore EP called Tell Me You Love Me Again, which will be out on Friday, and it is incredible. It's like just over 13 minutes, and it's so good, and I've been listening to it like nonstop. But anyway, go read it, because we talk about so many things. We talk about roller derby. We talk about Scott Pilgrim versus the World, the Canadian classic. We talk about them playing Pooza Fest the first time. Also, memories of Pooza Fest that they've gone to. If you want to know the reason behind or the meaning behind the title, it's hidden somewhere in the thingy, the intro there. This is one of the most fun interviews I've ever done, and I love talking with them, and a bunch of stuff I had to cut out because it was like, if I don't cut this out, it's going to be really, really long and it's not going to make any sense. But I wish I had kept it in. We talked a lot about like coffee and dabs and stuff, like the dance move and emojis that dab and all sorts of things. So go read that. And then depending on when this episode airs, you might also be able to read my interview with Ben of Real Sickies. We're releasing Life Under a Bag on Friday as well.
Well, there you have it. And what song should we send them one out with?
Ooh, do you want to do New Rose by The Damned?
Yes.
As
yes.
a tribute?
Yes, I do. Good choice.
Oh,
this
thanks.
is New Rose by The Damned, and we will see you
next week.
Is she really going out with him?
Strange like a stormy sea. I don't know why, I don't know why. I guess these things have gotta be. I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Guess I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. I got a brand new rose in town. See the sun, it shines. Don't get too close or it'll burn your eyes. Don't you run away that way. You can come back another day. I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Guess I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. I've got a brand new rose in town. I never thought this could happen to me. I feel so strange. Oh, why should it be? I don't deserve somebody this great. Oh, I better go, or it'll be too late. Like a stormy sea. I don't know why, I don't know why. I guess these things have gotta be. I got a new rose, I got a good. Guess I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. Like a brand new rose.